Good morning, everybody. My name's Michael Green. I'm the clerk of the list that Robert and Sam are members of. Thanks very much for coming in this morning for our property law breakfast briefing. Our first presenter is Robert Hay. Robert's got an early date with the Court of Appeal, so he has to get away by, I think, about 8:30 or so. Therefore, any questions for Robert, please feel free to ask as he presents his paper. Raise your hand and ask if you'd like to, or at the end of Rob's paper before we have a break, so that he can help you and deal with any questions that may arise. Now, this morning, as you know, is Leases, Litigation and Liquidations. Snappy title, dreamt up by Sam Hopper. Robert speaking first, and Robert's paper is VCAS Jurisdiction, Bank Guarantees and Liens. Rob's a property law specialist, been in practice about 25 years, about 20 of those years at the bar, and he works, the majority of his practice is property law in all its guises and forms. He's an active member of the Law Institute's Victorian Leasing Committee, does case notes, or is the case note editor of the Property Law Journal. He's also co-author of three LexisNexis texts in the property law area: Commercial Tenancy Law, The Mortgagee's Power of Sale, the third edition, which has just been released and published in the last few weeks, and Retail Leases Victoria. And I think all three, Rob, you co-author with Mr Justice Croft of the Supreme Court. So please welcome Robert Hay to talk on VCAT's jurisdiction, bank guarantees and liens.
Thank you. The first thing I want to say is that there's an absolute howl in paragraph 1C. It's nothing to do with key money. It's to do with distress for rent. Right. I think the main issue probably for most of you are the first two, that is, where there's an arrears of rent with a lease, should a landlord commence a proceeding in VCAT or a court? And secondly, the issues that can arise with calling on bank guarantees that have been given as security for a tenant's obligations under a lease. If we have the time, I'll deal with the third as well. And as I said, the third one relates to distress for rent, not key money. I don't know what I was thinking about when I put those words there. Well, OK, VCAT's jurisdiction, this often causes problems. Apart from claims for relief against forfeiture and claims concerning unconscionable conduct, VCAT has exclusive jurisdiction to hear and determine a retail tenancy dispute. And that is very widely defined to mean a dispute between a landlord and a tenant, among other things, arising under or in relation to a retail premises lease. Now, because of the words relate, the relation to, that's very wide, catches all sorts of things. And I've mentioned a case there called Seidler, which the court said relate itself would appear to mean to have some association or connection with. So you can imagine if something's related to something else, it doesn't need a direct and immediate connection. It's very wide. So many disputes, the field is vast for issues that are going to be caught by the definition and have to go to VCAT because VCAT has exclusive jurisdiction. However, a dispute relating to solely to the payment of rent is not a retail tenancies dispute, and this is where problems arise. If a landlord has a claim for rent, should it issue in VCAT or a court? It could issue in VCAT, even though it's not a retail tenancies dispute, assuming there's no dispute and it's just a claim for rent, because it's also a consumer and trader dispute within the meaning of sections 182, 184, etc. of the Australian Consumer Law and Fair Trading Act 2012. So VCAT has a jurisdiction to hear cases that relate to land. You'll see the definition of service there I've put in paragraph 6, includes rights in relation to an interest in real property. So that's the definition of services, is very widely defined to include interests in relation to real property. So you can always get a leasing case into VCAT. You also can get disputes about licences into VCAT. So you could bring a case concerning a claim for rent in VCAT, even if there's no other issue involved. However, it commonly occurs that landlords issue in courts, magistrates court, county court normally, and the tenant puts his hand up and says, well, I actually do have a dispute, and then the issue becomes, can the case continue in the court, or should it be stayed or dismissed, and the landlord have to start all over again in VCAT. Now, obviously, if there are advantages and disadvantages to a landlord going to a court, if the claim relates solely to rent and is commenced in a court, a successful landlord will inevitably be awarded costs. Also, the judgment can be enforced without further steps being taken. By that I mean, if you bring the proceeding in VCAT and get a judgment, you have to actually go and get it registered in a real court, normally the magistrate's court, to get it enforced. There are also procedural advantages to being in a court. The landlord can obtain default judgment or be given summary judgment in appropriate circumstances. Also, the regime for obtaining interest is clearly defined. Sections 58 to 60 of the Supreme Court Act give you a suite there of choices for claiming interest. However, you issue in a court and the tenant raises the point that it does have a dispute. If the court decides that there is a dispute, then the landlord itself could face costs, particularly if the proceedings stayed and the tenant had raised these issues before the landlord commenced in the court. Obviously, if the tenant didn't raise the issues, the tenant may be the one liable for the costs for the landlord wrongfully commencing a proceeding in the wrong jurisdiction, or there might be no order as to costs. But the main issue for a landlord in those circumstances is the delay involved, I think. I've been involved with a couple of these, and you know, by the time you get the stay application heard and determined and county court says, no, you're wrong place, then you've got to go through a procedure to start all over again in VCAT, and because it now is a retail tenancies dispute, you also have to have the mediation process. So it can actually lead to quite a substantial delay, and obviously you have a very unhappy client too. Now, if you go in VCAT, if you go start off the proceeding in VCAT, now assuming it is a retail tenancies dispute, in other words, it's not just solely related to rent, as a general rule, costs are not awarded, and that's made clear by Section 92. So a landlord's not going to get costs in those circumstances. VCAT has power to award interest under the Retail Leases Act. You look at Section 91.2. It's discretionary, and it's not particularly prescriptive about the sort of issues VCAT should take into account. And in paragraph 9, I've just included a quote there from a couple of cases I was involved in where senior member Vassi explained how the tribunal normally approaches the interest provisions. He said, the view that the tribunal usually takes is that because an order for the payment of money vindicates a claim that was made when the initiating application was filed, the calculation of interest should commence from the date of filing. Now, obviously, if you're claiming rent, you probably want it from the date you made your demand rather than the date of filing. Now, if the claim is issued in VCAT and it's not a retail tenancies dispute, Section 92, that's the cost provision, doesn't apply. The relevant provision is Section 109 of the VCAT Act, which is its cost provision. Now, it is also restrictive as to the ability to award costs, but not nearly as restrictive as the provision in the Retail Leases Act. But you should assume the landlord's not likely to get its costs. There's also no simple default judgment procedure or summary judgment procedure in VCAT. And as I said, you need to register any judgment in a court. Now, VCAT does have power to award interest when it's a consumer and trader dispute and can award similar interest to the Supreme Court, can award interest in the nature of damages. There's no doubt about that, and I've referred to those provisions there. This is in paragraph 10. So, if there's going to be a debate about whether there is a dispute, you should really go and VCAT. There's no doubt about that. There's one caveat I'll make on that. If the rent provision says, for example, that rent must be paid without deduction, any deduction whatsoever, in Victoria, there's probably a good argument that even if the tenant has a cross-claim of some sort, that the court will allow the case for rent to proceed, because in Victoria, the usual position is that if rent is to be paid without deduction, The words mean what they say, and a cross-claim is completely irrelevant. The tenant's got to pay the rent. It can run its cross-claim at another time, another place, but it's irrelevant to the issue of paying rent. So if you have that type of situation, it may well be okay to bring the proceeding in a court. Now, I'll deal with some of the cases. Probably the best known is a case called Zampelis and Nahas. In that case, a lessor issued a summons in the magistrate's court claiming arrears of rent. The lessee denied the debt and pleaded that the landlord had breached the lease by failing to ensure the tenant free access. Now, the lessor's complaint was dismissed on the basis that although the action by a lessor could come within, be brought in the magistrate's court if it related solely to rent, because there was now a dispute, the whole proceeding should be referred to arbitration. Now, this is in the period where the Retail Tenancies Act 1986 applied, and in those days, the disputes were determined by arbitration, and the arbitrator had exclusive jurisdiction. So the magistrate determined that it was a dispute between the lessor and the lessee, which was not related solely to the claim for rent. That's because of the cross-claim. He ruled that he had no jurisdiction to hear the matter, and the cross-claim had to be referred to arbitration. And Justice Nathan said on appeal, "I find the legislation crystal clear in the Act. All disputes relating to a retail tenancy, save those by a landlord solely for the payment of rent, must be referred to arbitration. In this case, the dispute had broadened beyond the landlord's claim because it attracted a defence dealing with the performance of the covenants." So that's the case that's often referred to. Very recently in the county court, there was a case called Cavano, and I refer to this in paragraph 12. The landlord commenced a proceeding claiming rent. The tenant then filed an application with a small business commissioner seeking mediation of the dispute, and the application to the SBC alleged that the lease was invalid, the premises were not fit for purpose, and the landlord had breached the covenant of quiet enjoyment. It's unfortunate what Judge LaCava did here. He held that in deciding whether the proceeding should be stayed, it was not necessary to decide the strength or otherwise of the application lodged with the SBC, and that ultimately this was a matter for VCAT to decide. Now, of course, that means that a tenant can effectively say anything, if you're going to take that approach, to avoid the jurisdiction of the court. And it was the landlord's submission in that case that the tenant's alleged cross-claim was hopeless and frivolous, but his honour wouldn't look at it. And also there was a related proceeding against a guarantor, and he also stayed that proceeding because he said the tenant's case is that there's no lease, so if there's no lease, the guarantor can't be liable. So the proceeding was stayed. Now, the approach that I would prefer is the one taken by Associate Justice Gardner in a case called Figgins Holdings, and I mentioned this in paragraph 13. In that case, a tenant applied to set aside a statutory demand. The demand concerned arrears of rent and outgoings. The tenant then applied to the Small Business Commissioner for a mediation on the basis there was a dispute, and then sought to adjourn its application to set aside the statutory demand. So it's going to be a great delaying process here. Unlike Judge LaCava and Cavano, Associate Justice Gardner undertook a detailed examination of the tenant's claim that it had a retail tenancies dispute, really examined the merits of it, and decided that there was no genuine and bona fide dispute. So in that case, that the allegation or the attempt to avoid the court was unsuccessful. Anyway, it's a problem for landlords particularly, and you have to think carefully about it. Now, given the time, I'll move on to another issue which can be of major significance to landlords and tenants. I make the comment in paragraph 15 that a tenant should be very slow to seek an injunction to restrain a landlord from drawing down on a bank guarantee provided to secure a tenant's obligations under a lease. Now, there was a recent case which highlights this, a case called Otter Group. It was, in fact, decided only a few weeks ago. A tenant sought an injunction to restrain the landlord from dealing with the proceeds of a bank guarantee. Now, the guarantee had been given to secure the tenant's obligations under the lease. There was a big dispute about whether the tenant had complied with all its make good obligations. The guarantee was, and this is really quite bizarre, was drawn down while a mediation was in process, and I can understand why the tenant's lawyers got very upset about that. But question the court had to decide was whether there was a serious question to be tried about the landlord's entitlement to draw down on the guarantee pending resolution of the underlying dispute. Now, the actual principles are quite clear, and I've set them out almost verbatim from that case. Firstly, an injunction will issue to prevent a party in whose favour the performance guarantee has been given from acting fraudulently. That's obvious. So if there's fraud involved, court will give you an injunction. Also, you can get an injunction where a party is acting unconscionably, but you've got to remember that that does not mean anything that you don't like, or the courts have been quite strict in really looking for reprehensible behaviour in deciding what is unconscionable. Now, I've mentioned the Trade Practices Act there, but of course the Australian Consumer Law is now relevant as well. The third one, and that's the most important one, and I would ask you to put a comma after the word pay in the second line. This is in subparagraph C. So, while a court will not restrain the issuer of a performance guarantee from acting on an unqualified promise to pay, if the party in whose favour the guarantee has been given has given a contractual promise that it will not draw down except in certain circumstances, then a court will give the injunction if those circumstances don't arise. So, in those circumstances, where the actual guarantee or the lease sets out precisely when you can and cannot draw down on the guarantee, and its guarantee is drawn out down on one of the circumstances where it shouldn't have been drawn down, you will get an injunction. In other words, just look at the documents. The leading case is probably a case called Clough, and I've mentioned that there. It's actually 249. The figures 249 are missing, so it's 2008 249 ALR. Now, in the Otter case, the court held there was no evidence that the landlord was acting fraudulently or unconscionably, so it came down to the terms of the lease. The tenant relied on the provisions in the bank guarantee clause that referred to the tenant as failing to pay the rent, so it could be drawn down when the tenant failed to pay the rent, or the landlord suffering loss or damage because of any other breach. And it contended that those words meant that those words could not be satisfied until a court actually determined that there had been a failure to pay the rent or a breach. And this is what the court said. The rationale for the general rule, that is, the general rule that a landlord can draw down, is that by providing for security to be given, the parties implicitly agree that the party giving the security deposit shall be out of pocket. The party giving the security deposit shall be out of pocket pending resolution of the underlying dispute. In other words, the person giving the guarantee is the one who's going to be out of pocket until the dispute is resolved. It's a risk. This really comes from building cases where the court said what's happened here is the risk has been given to, it's normally in building cases, it's the builder. In leasing cases, it's the tenant. The risk is on the tenant, and once the dispute's resolved, you might be able to sort out who's entitled, who is ultimately right. But the first port of call is the landlord can draw down. The court considered the full federal court's decision in Clough. And this is critical, what they said. The court said in Clough, clear words will be required to support a construction which inhibits a beneficiary from calling on a performance guarantee where a breach is alleged in good faith, that is, non-fraudulently. So it's not enough where the words arguably support the position that the guarantee can't be drawn down upon until there's actually an established breach. That's not going to get you a successful injunction. The words need to be absolutely clear that in the circumstances that you're facing, the landlord cannot draw down. Then you can get an injunction. Otherwise, don't go near the court. This was very costly for Otter. And, of course, it's psychologically a very bad thing at the start of a case to lose a situation like that. And the tenant in that case has real merits. The judgment actually says that there is a real dispute about the make good issues. Now, I've been involved in a couple of these cases, not seeking to restrain the drawing down, but where there has been a drawing down. And tactically, I know others dispute this, I think it's a huge tactical advantage for the landlord to be able to do that. Because what happens is then at a mediation and in subsequent court proceedings, there's an automatic assumption that some of the money is going to stay with the landlord. Certainly at mediations, this is the assumption. And this sort of psychology at the mediation is the landlord is really got the guarantee, and it's really up to the tenant to show precisely why the landlord's not entitled to it. So the starting position always is, psychologically, at least on the landlord's point of view, that it's got the money and it's really up to the tenant to justify why the landlord shouldn't have the money. And the ones I've been involved in, generally it settles quite well for the landlord, irrespective of the underlying merits. Particularly, this often arises in situations where the tenant's alleged not to have complied with make good obligations. And it sometimes can reverse the onus of proof. The landlord draws down on the guarantee, the tenant goes to court to say you weren't entitled to draw down on the guarantee, and the tenant effectively has to prove why the landlord wasn't entitled to draw down on the guarantee. So if the landlord plays its cards right, it can sometimes force the tenant to prove that wasn't in breach, rather than the landlord having to prove that the tenant was in breach. The last issue I'll deal with is a recent case called Sharon Lee Holdings, which it contains an interesting discussion about distress for rent and also possessory liens. Now, Section 12 of the Landlord and Tenant Act 1958 declared that distress for rent was abolished in August 1948. Now, the Landlord and Tenant Act has been repealed. Despite that repeal, the prohibition on distress for rent remains in force by reason of provisions in the Interpretation of Legislation Act. So just because you don't see a piece of legislation that says it's been abolished because the Landlord and Tenant Act no longer exists, and that said it, doesn't mean that you can now distrain for rent. There's a very good discussion in the case and about what is distress for rent. And if you go to the last page of the paper, you'll see there's a figure 26 appears at the top of the page. This is from part of a judgment by Justice Gard. Distress for rent could only be levied when a tenancy was actually subsisting. In other words, if the tenancy had ended, there's no issue about distress for rent. If the landlord had taken possession of the property, there's no issue about distress for rent. The landlord cannot distrain for rent if it's in possession. So once a tenancy had been terminated by notice to quit, distress could not be levied, even for rent which had accrued before the expiry of the notice. If the landlord elected to forfeit the lease for breach of covenant, the landlord could not therefore distrain for rent. Now, a landlord need not necessarily sell distressed goods, but he had the power to do so, and there was no action against the landlord for not selling the distressed goods. Now, this case, Sharon Lee Holdings, concerned what was on its face, a possessory lien. And now that's a lien created by contract, comes into existence when the contract's made, and it becomes exercisable at the moment when the contingencies on which the lien is granted are satisfied. In other words, there's some sort of breach. It's called a possessory lien because it's only possible to be exercised if you actually have possession of the goods. Now, this case, Sharon Lee Holdings, a limited, an Asian Pacific building corporation, started in VCAT. In that case, the landlord re-entered leased premises and forfeited the lease. So, in other words, the lease is over. Remember what I said about distress for rent. Clause 8 of the lease provided that the lessor shall have maintained a lien on all the goods, chattels and equipment of the lessee in the premises upon the lessee being in breach of its very badly worded clause, of its under the lease, and the lessee agrees the lessor may remove and retain the said goods, chattels and equipment until the lessee has paid the lessor all amounts of money owing to the lessor by the lessee. So badly worded clause, but you often see that kind of clause in leases. Now, the landlord retained the tenant's goods because rent hadn't been paid. The tenant contended that the seizure of the goods was unlawful and that the lien claimed by the landlord was unenforceable because it had the effect of granting the landlord a right to distress for rent. In response to that, the landlord said that distress for rent could only be levied during the subsistence of the tenancy, and that's correct. And because the lease had ended, the prohibition on distress for rent was not infringed, and the clause merely gave the landlord a right to a possessory lien, which did not come into effect until the landlord actually took possession of the goods. Now, in VCAT, it's a complex and difficult decision to follow, but essentially, senior member Regler found that clause authorised conduct which was prohibited by statute, that is the distress for rent, that it was void and unenforceable, and that it was against public policy, and that, and this is where it became very messy, he decided that while it wasn't in fact distress for rent, because the goods were seized and retained after the lease had come to an end. So in other words, even though there was public policy reason why you couldn't enforce it, it actually wasn't distress for rent because the seizure occurred after the lease had come to an end. But the court then went on to decide that the goods were not retained pursuant to a contractual lien because the lease had come to an end, the contract had come to an end, so then there was nothing. There was no lien because the contract was at an end. Now, Justice Gard heard all this and he came to a different view. And I've set out essentially what he said on the last page. His Honour held that, and what he did was analyse what distress for rent was, analyse what a possessory lien was. Probably the most important points I mentioned on page 8 are the one in D, little subparagraph D. The lien applied to all obligations under the lease and not merely to the covenant to pay rent. So that's significant. If you're drafting one of these clauses, don't just restrict it to rent. The lien could be confined in its operation as it affected rent to the period after the termination of the tenancy. You might recall this lien wasn't restricted to the period after the tenancy, but there's a common interpretation the courts take that if something can be done in a way that's illegal or legal, if you do it the illegal way, the provision's unenforceable. If you do it the legal way, it's fine. So what he's saying here is that so far as affected rent, it's fine, given the fact the lien was exercised after the termination of the tenancy. Also, the lien did not empower the sale of any goods, as it would be the landlord's right in seeking distress for rent. Now, I actually don't think this clause is really worth the trouble, because all you need is a provision in your lease, and many leases have this, that goods left on the premises are deemed to be abandoned. I know there's some argument about the validity of those too, but in Victoria you see it a lot. So you often see these clauses, goods left behind are deemed to be abandoned and become the property of the landlord, which means the landlord can do what they like with them. But if you're going to have these clauses, make sure they apply to all obligations under the lease and not just to rent. Make sure that it doesn't apply only to the period during the lease. So, in other words, the obligation will continue afterwards. The landlord can exercise the lien afterwards. Make sure it doesn't empower the sale of goods too. You probably should also be aware now that Part 4.2 of the Australian Consumer Law and Fair Trading Act deals with abandoned goods. Those provisions used to be in the Landlord and Tenant Act. If you want to look there, you can look for those provisions. That's probably all I want to say on that issue. They're not something that I'm a great fan of. You also would need, in the case of a possessory lien, you would need to think about registration under the Personal Property Security Act these days, which I'm not talking about that today. So thank you. If you've got any questions, fire away.
Robert, could you please just repeat the reference to the Act that you just mentioned?
Oh, okay. I've referred to it in paragraph 10, at the bottom of paragraph 10. It's the Australian Consumer Law and Fair Trading Act. It replaced the Fair Trading Act in Victoria.